today at Reader's Corner, Marcel Dursis, author of How Tyrants Fall and How Nations Survive. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In his new book, How Tyrants Fall and How Nations Survive, political scientist Marcel Dursis meets with coup leaders, dissidents, and soldiers to examine the workings and malfunctions of tyrants, whether it's their inner circle turning against them, the resentment of elites in the military, or the masses alienated by cronyism, or even revolutionaries plotting in exile. Tyrants always have more enemies than friends. Dr. Marcel Dursis is a political scientist and non-resident fellow at the Institute for Security Policy at Kiel University in Germany. His work has appeared in Foreign Policy, The New York Times, The Washington Post, among many other outlets. He writes the popular politics newsletter, The Hundred, on Substack. Marcel Dursis, welcome to Reader's Corner, all the way from Hamburg, Germany.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, Marcel, you tell the reader that by 2012, less than 12% of countries remained closed autocracies. That is the type of system in which citizens don't really get any choice at all. In fact, you conclude your book with the statement that tyrants have gone from being the rule to being the exception. What's the percentage like in 2024? Do we know that? Was it still around 12%?
I'd have to look it up. I get the sense that it might have gotten slightly worse. But the point that I wanted to get at was that sometimes, you know, everything can seem very doomy. You know, it's all gloom. It's all doom. Whenever you turn on the news, bad things seem to be happening. Democracies appear to be struggling, and these despots appear to be strong. But when you look at things in a long-term perspective, a lot of things have gotten vastly better. The world is much more democratic than it used to be. And like you say, democracy, in a sense, is almost normal.
Well, that's good news for us over here in the United States of America. Let's talk about the personality type of a tyrant. Give us some thoughts on that.
One misconception that people sometimes have is that these dictators, these tyrants, are madmen, you know, that they're somehow totally immune to incentives. But I don't think that's true. The vast majority of these people within the systems in which they operate are rational. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're normal. You know, they're not. They're not like you or I. You know, they have an abnormal personality in some sense. You know, they might lack empathy. It might be impossible for them to think through the consequences of their actions and how it might impact other people around them. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they have lost the plot.
They're not necessarily insane.
No, I don't think they are. And, you know, the point that I make in the book is that in order to stay in power the vast majority of the time, you cannot afford to be insane because you have a variety of trade-offs to make and you have to make them again and again and again. And if you don't, then you're going to lose power pretty quickly. So one of the examples I talk about is a leader during the Cold War named Masias Ngema in West Africa. And, you know, he was an exceedingly cruel leader. You know, he would torture, he would kill. But what ultimately brought him down was that he literally lost the plot. And I mean, you know, I'm not just saying that, oh, he went crazy. I'm saying that he literally went crazy. He became delusional. So you would walk around his, you know, his compound crying out the names of the people that he had killed. And in one instance, he would ask his servants to lay the table for 8 guests. But even though none of them arrived, he talked to his quote unquote guests as if they were there. So he was delusional and he started lashing out and no longer really differentiating between friend and foe. And as a result of that, the elites that had previously kept him in power decided that they would have to make a move because there was every chance that they would be next. So if you become irrational, if you become detached from reality too much, you are going to lose power. And when you lose power, there's a good chance that you're going to end up in exile, in prison, or killed.
Right. And we're going to talk about that in a moment. But first of all, tell us about the dictator's treadmill. It sums up the life of a dictator. And I assume you're using the terms tyrant and dictator interchangeably.
Yeah. So, you know, if you're a democratic leader, by and large, you know, you've got a tranquil retirement to look forward to. So if you're, let's say, Rishi Sunak in the UK or, you know, you're Joe Biden in the United States, losing power is not the end of the world. You know, you might be able to spend time with family, you might be able to found a charity, or you might be able to give speeches to banks. But if you're a tyrant, your retirement plan looks very different in that the risk is enormously high that something bad is going to happen to you once you're no longer in that palace and once you're no longer in control. So a lot of these leaders come into power thinking that they're going to get all this wealth, they're going to hold all this power, and it's going to be great. But once they're there, they risk becoming trapped because they can no longer voluntarily step down, even if they want to. So because it's so dangerous to lose power, they then have an incentive to do anything they can in order to maintain that power. And the argument that I advance in the book is that this fear of losing power and, sort of being stuck in this dictator's treadmill then has a big influence on the way that these leaders govern.
Well, stepping down clearly isn't a very good choice for tyrants. And maybe you should give us an example. The one I remember from reading your book is Charles Taylor, once the tyrant of Nigeria. How'd that work out for him?
One of the problems for these people is that, exile has become increasingly difficult. So it used to be during the Cold War, when the Western bloc was facing off against the Soviet Union, that even democracies were oftentimes quite happy to provide exile to some of these horrendous leaders because they were their thugs, so to speak, and they calculated that it was worth it to provide them with a safe haven after losing power. But over time, it's gotten vastly more difficult for the worst of the worst to find a place in exile because there have been advances in international justice. Voters are more likely to want these people to be held accountable. So that means that, even if you do make some sort of deal to step down from power, it is far from guaranteed that the other side is going to hold up their end of that. And what you saw with Charles Taylor is that he thought, okay, well, I am going to step down, but it is going to be okay because I will be protected by this government that has made an agreement with me. But what ultimately happened is that that agreement got torn to shreds because the government that had promised to take care of him got pressured into giving him up. And as a result of that, he's now spending the rest of his life in a jail cell, which is obviously not something that anybody is keen on.
You mentioned the advances in international justice. It reminds me of the International Criminal Court, which I think you attribute to one of the differences that exiles face now as opposed to what they used to face. Tell us about the International Criminal Court. Who's in charge? How did it get assembled? And anything else that you think is relevant here to better understanding just how tyrants have a tougher time of surviving these days.
Yeah, so the idea behind these international efforts at bringing about justice is that when the local government is unable or unwilling to provide some sort of accountability for, let's say, a rebel leader that has committed war crimes or a statesman that has committed crimes against humanity, then there is another institutions that can step in and do something about it. But what I write about in the book is that this is something of a double-edged sword. So on the one hand, you would think, well, it's a great thing that these people are being held accountable in some sort of way, even if it is abroad. But the flip side of that is, like I said, it is much more difficult to step down as a result of, the court and all the also some other institutions. So if you are a leader and you do face, let's say, a mass protest out in the street, you have all the more incentive to try to cling to power because now not only can you be held accountable by your own people, but also by people in a faraway place. So if you have to make a decision between, shooting or not shooting, or torturing or not torturing, now you are even more likely to take the route of shooting and torturing.
That's a considerable irony there that the folks who set up the International Criminal Court thought they were doing such a great job at getting at these exiles, but all they may be doing is keeping them in power even longer.
I think one of the things that I miss in the German political discussion, and perhaps it's the same in the US, is that I think we don't think about trade-offs enough. So, oftentimes when politicians talk to voters, they say, well, there's no alternative, or we have to do it this way and everything is going to get better. Or they say, if we do it this way, everything is going to get worse. And, that's just not the truth. In politics, very few things are free. And oftentimes you get one thing, you lose another. You can't have it all. And I think we have to be a lot more honest with ourselves in discussing, these types of dictatorial systems, even though sometimes it might be depressing to hear it, but understanding them properly is the basis for dealing with them properly.
Well, my Russian history isn't so great if it ever was. And I read your book and I continue thinking of Vladimir Putin in present day. But before we go there, take us back in Russian history and tell us about Peter the Great, or maybe I should say Peter the Not So Great, at least in the eyes of his wife. And what happened then?
Yeah, you're right. So I read about Catherine the Great, who originally, of course, was German, but then, you know, came to Russia and sought to ingratiate herself with the Russian people and also the Russian court. And what happened was, is that, you know, the Tsar lost the support of his wife, who was very, very good at courting the elites that kept the Tsar in power. And eventually she managed to overthrow him. And once he was overthrown, he died very quickly. And the point that I'm trying to make in that story is that these systems operate very differently to democracies. So if you want to be in power in the United States, you need to convince millions and millions of people to vote for you. You know, and even if you look, let's say, just at the swing states, that's still a considerable share of the population of the United States. But the less democratic you are, the fewer and fewer people you need in order to attain power or to maintain it. So if you look at something like, let's say, Kim Jong-un in North Korea, he only needs the support of maybe 100 families in order to stay in power. But the flip side of that is what you saw with Catherine the Great, where when the Tsar lost the support of his wife and a couple of important guards that were supposed to keep the royal family safe, he lost power and subsequently he lost his life. So, you know, there's a flip side to this. On the one hand, you only need to manage very few people and, you know, those are the only people you need to keep happy. But at the same time, losing them can be catastrophic very, very quickly. And that same mechanism that we saw with Catherine the Great, you know, hundreds of years ago, still applies today in something like Putin's Russia.
You're listening to Marcel Dursis. He's the author of How Tyrants Fall and How Nations Survive. You define a winning coalition, Marcel, as what it takes to put a tyrant in power. How does that work?
Like I said, the more democratic you are, the more people you need in order to maintain power and vice versa. So think of your government as being on a spectrum somewhere between the most democratic society imaginable and Kim Jong-un's North Korea. The winning coalition is the group of people that you require in order to get power or to maintain power. And the size of this can vary tremendously between different systems of power. So in the US, for example, you know, nominally, you would have every voter that matters. But in reality, as we can see now with these presidential elections, what really matters are the voters in a couple of swing states, right? So the winning coalition really is the smallest number of people that you need in order to hold on to that power or to take that power in the first place. And the size of it has a massive influence on the way that you govern. Because if you're a dictator and you know that you only need a very small number of people in order to maintain power, you are going to govern accordingly. So if you are, let's say, Putin, right, and money comes in, and you have a choice between spending it on the oligarchs or the generals that keep you in power, or spending it on a school for ordinary people in some Siberian village, you're not going to spend it on that school. Because it doesn't really matter what the people in that Siberian village want. You know, they have no power, they have no influence, and they cannot really become a threat. So, you know, this winning coalition sounds quite abstract, but it can have a massive influence on everyday politics in these countries.
You mentioned Putin. It reminds me of a point in your book where you're talking about how easy it is for dictators to isolate themselves, at least from the people they rule. And you share with the readers the story of Putin in the winter of 2022 when he sat down with 17 mothers of sons who were fighting in Ukraine. At least that's the way it looked. Tell us what happened. And I bring this up not just because it's in your book, but because it's something about the measure of the man who is now waging this war against Ukraine. And I just think it's important for our listeners to know a little bit about the charades that goes on over there.
Yeah, so one of the advantages of these dictators like Putin is that they don't really have to come into contact with ordinary people. And to the extent that they do come into contact with supposedly ordinary people, they can fake it. So instead of Putin meeting with the actual mothers of, you know, people that were fighting his war in Ukraine, you know, they were all either financed by the regime, selected by the regime on the basis of their loyalty to the regime. But of course, you know, if you're a Russian and you just turn on the TV and you're being told, look, these are the mothers of, you know, of these people fighting in Ukraine, you might believe it. And this, of course, is a luxury that only dictators have. I mean, if an American president or a British prime minister or a German chancellor were to try to do the same, he would be outed by investigative journalists. You know, it would run wall to wall on, you know, every television
Right.
channel in the country. So this is something that democratic leaders really cannot do. So one of the advantages that these dictators have is that in some sense, they have a lower risk of that happening to them. Precisely because they don't need to meet those voters. You know, they don't really need to campaign. They don't need to shake hands. They don't need to be in touch with, you know, people that aren't pre-selected. So as a result of that, you know, their chance of assassination is in some way lower than it would be for democratic leaders. Because in democracies, leaders need to do all of those things. They need to be out there. They need to be in touch with people. And that puts them at a much greater risk.
I was fascinated by the work you discovered and discussed in your book, the work of Dr. Gerald Post, his analysis of Saddam Hussein in Iraq as a malignant narcissist. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Gerald Post, worked for the CIA, and one of the things that he did was look at the psychological makeup of political leaders abroad, one of them being Saddam Hussein. And what he found is that the psychological makeup of these people is not normal. You know, there might be psychopaths. You know, they're able to use extreme violence and still look at themselves in the mirror. But importantly, what he found for Saddam Hussein, for example, was that he never lost his desire to maintain power. So, you know, he never lost connection to reality. He didn't become delusional. And his overriding aim was to maintain in power. And that influenced his choices. You know, he wasn't looking to be a martyr for some sort of greater cause. You know, so that the implication of that is that he would respond to the right incentives if given. And, you know, I think sometimes in the public discussion, we like to tell ourselves that these people are crazy because it is more comforting to think of them as crazy and irrational than to think of them as retaining some sort of rationality. Because it's, you know, I think the truth in this case is quite depressing.
You know, that reminds me of a comment in your book. I don't remember which tyrant you were talking about, but he said, "I will never be identified as the former president." I
That's
thought,
Mobutu. That's
Mobutu, yeah.
Mobutu. Yeah,
Yeah, I mean,
so
that tells it all right there, doesn't
yeah, it does
it?
tell it all. You know, and I obviously, you know, in the book I sort of make it, you know, I make a sort of a joke that obviously these, you know, these tyrants won't have read sort of the latest research on the fate of, you know, former personalist dictators,
Right.
but that doesn't mean that they're not aware of it. You know,
Right.
when these other tyrants fall, they see it, they notice it, and it has implications for the way that they try to hold on to power.
Yeah.
Because, you know, not only are these people not irrational, but most of them also aren't stupid.
So how does a tyrant coup-proof his regime against those that might challenge him and attempt to set up their own regime?
You know, the men with guns really are one of the primary threats to most dictators. You know, they need to be managed. You need to take care of the generals. You need to take care of the soldiers. And one of the ways that you can coup-proof, as you say, is to counterbalance, for example. So if you have a liberal democracy, the way that your security forces are structured might be quite unitary. So you might have just one military, and the point of that military is to defend the country from foreign threats. But if you're a dictator, what you really want is to split that military. So you want to have a regular military, you want to have, let's say, a large militia. But then in addition to that large militia, you might also want to have a militarized palace guard. And then you want to repeat that same thing with your security services as well. Because what you want to avoid is a scenario in which one general can decide that he wants to overthrow you and then go ahead and just do it. You want to have a scenario where even if that general wants to overthrow you, he knows that he would have to go through more and more soldiers in order to try to remove you from power. And you want overlapping responsibilities. You know, you want the agents to watch each other as opposed to just watching the actual threats. Because to a lot of tyrants, the actual threats is their own military. So you split the military, you split the security forces in order to counterbalance each of the individual forces. And once you've done that, you try to make sure that the generals don't spend too much time with one another. So what you don't want is to have the, you know, the head of your military spending a lot of time with the head of foreign intelligence or with the Minister of Interior. Because if you did have that, you know, they might coordinate, they might conspire behind your back and so forth. So there are a lot of options to get this done. And sometimes they even feel quite basic. So in the case of Saudi Arabia, for example, what they did was they would move their regular military out away from the capital and then physically put that parallel military between the capital and the regular military. Because to the Saudi royal family at the time, the main threat wasn't some foreign power, it was their own military, absurdly.
You know, as I listen to you, Marcel, it occurs to me that you've written a handbook for up and coming tyrants. This thing actually might change that percentage we're trying to keep down here. You've done such a great job of identifying how you do this.
It's not an unfair thing to say. I mean, I did think about that while I was writing the book. I will say in my defense that I think it is quite difficult not to do that when you're
Right.
trying to describe how they fall, right?
Sure,
Because if
sure.
you describe if you describe or analyze how they fall, you're inevitably going to give away some tips.
Right.
The best I can hope for is that this book is unlikely to get published in Russia or China.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Marcel Dursis, author of How Tyrants Fall and How Nations Survive. So I was very impressed with the research you found on the secret wars the U.S. has waged against tyrants and which American interventions worked and which did not. Give us the scorecard on that.
So, when it comes to these interventions, I think it makes sense to sort of differentiate between overt efforts to replace regimes and covert effort to replace regimes. So, your overt operations would be something like the Iraq War, where you use the, full might of the military in order to go after some adversarial regime. When it comes to these open regime change operations, the track record is pretty abysmal. So there are very few cases in which a military intervention successfully paved the way for a liberal democracy thereafter. And, there are a couple of reasons for that. One of the reasons that I describe in the book is the difficulty of dealing with former elites of that regime. Because obviously, when you go in and let's say you do manage to topple that dictator, you have to manage what to do about everybody else that was sort of around the dictator, right? That might have been in the dictator's party or that might have worked in the dictator's civil service. And there's not really a good option here because if you purge them effectively, you reduce the capacity of the state. Because, of course, a lot of these people might be teachers or they might be technocrats or they might be working in some sort of administrative capacity. And if you remove them all, you make it harder for the state to keep operating. But if you don't remove them, obviously you have all these remnants of the very regime that you wanted to try to replace. So, in German, we would describe this as a choice between the plague and cholera. There's no good
Yeah,
option. You're going to lose
right.
either way, pretty much. So that's one of the difficulties there. And then when it comes to sort of overt action, more in the shadows, the difficulty is essentially that by trying to have that plausible deniability, you forgo a lot of the strength that you could bring to bear if you didn't care about it being hidden. And that makes it much more difficult to get it done. And it also means that you are more likely to accept a lower probability of success. So if you are the president of the United States and one of your advisors comes to you and says, look, we want to go to war, we want to take this dictator out, we think it has a 30% chance of success. The president's going to say, are you insane? Like, get out of my office, right?
Right.
But during the Cold War, when advisors pitched sort of operations in the shadow, and they said, look, admittedly, this has quite a low chance of success. Presidents were a lot more open to the idea of trying it anyway because they thought that the costs of these of covert action would be much lower, even if it did go wrong. And this, in a sort of weird way, makes covert action a more likely threat to dictators simply because democratic policymakers are more likely to go for it.
And didn't you give some kind of a batting average or percentage on how many of these American interventions worked and which ones did not?
Yeah, I think the statistic was 11%. So 11% of American regime change operations that these political scientists looked at led to liberal democracies thereafter.
Yeah.
But I will say, as a German, having grown up after the end of the Cold War, in
Sure.
prosperity, in freedom, I am not going to argue that using armed force to topple these types of leaders is never permissible. I can't say that, right? I think,
Yeah.
the boring answer that I give to people asking me about this is that it depends. You cannot say that this is never justified, but what I would try to convey to people is to be skeptical, because of course the stakes are very high, the risks are huge. So, there really needs to be a good justification for using violence to try to topple these people.
I want to fit in a question here toward the end of our time that I'm sure is on a lot of people's minds as they listen to our conversation today. There's an elephant in the room in this discussion called Vladimir Putin. I mean, you can pick up all these foreign policy articles and issues over the last few months and years, and every now and then it'll come up, well, will Putin be overthrown? And I know that your research on this book did not deal with that, but what are your thoughts on the possibility of some kind of a Kremlin coup taking him out? I mean, I haven't been able to find anybody who thinks that's really going to happen.
One thing that makes this so difficult is that these regimes are extremely opaque. So when you study democracies, there are a lot of things that come up again and again, and there's some sort of order to the way that these systems operate. And obviously, you don't have that with these types of dictatorships because so much happens in the shadow, and a lot of this these systems run on whispers and sort of cover up, right? So it is difficult to tell at any moment how stable these systems are. Even if we were to be on that track, we probably wouldn't know. So I think that's one of the difficulties. What I will say is that, from everything that I've researched, the most likely scenario through which he will be toppled are regime insiders. So the primary threat to somebody like Putin isn't the street. It's not masses out in the Kremlin, protesting against the war in Ukraine, for example. It's going to be the generals, it's going to be the economic elites, it might be, his own spies that ultimately try to take him out. Now, whether that does happen, I don't know, but I think we have at times come maybe quite close to it. So last year, for example, when Prigozhin's troops sort of went the wrong way, right? So instead of going to Ukraine, went up to Moscow. And there was a brief moment where Putin himself probably thought that he was in serious trouble. So I don't think it's impossible to imagine him falling. And I think if he does, it's going to be a result of regime insiders turning. Now, then, of course, the follow-up question might be, okay, when would they turn, right? And I think I could imagine them turning if things go badly in Ukraine. Now, at the moment, it doesn't look like that. It looks as if the Russian military is quite successful in advancing. But I could imagine a scenario where the men with guns, if they are being pushed back by the Ukrainians, think of all this fighting and all of this dying as essentially pointless. And there is quite a bit of research on these types of dictators losing power as a result of losing wars because it makes them look weak. And the other scenario that I can imagine is a scenario in which Putin himself shows some sort of physical weakness. So, if you're a dictator and you develop, let's say, some sort of physical ailment, you desperately need to keep that hidden. Because once people around you are become aware that, let's say, you have a serious heart disease, or that you might have developed cancer, it's not just a question of it being bad for you personally, obviously. But it can also lead to changed expectations among the people that keep you in power. Because, of course, they want money in 5 years and in 10 years from now. They want power in 5 years and in 10 years from now, and not just tomorrow. So, if, let's say, Putin were to develop a serious health issue and it would become public, or it would become common knowledge amongst those elites that we've just talked about, it could change their expectations and it could make them more likely to take a big risk by challenging him.
So let's squeeze in one more question, and we've really just about run out of time. The 3/5% rule. Initially, when Putin went into Ukraine, there was quite a few demonstrations out in the streets, and it reminds me of something you cover in your book, where you talk about the number of people that are actually engaged in protest of some kind. And there's this one piece of research that talks about the 3/5% rule. What is that?
Yeah. So the rule that you're referring to basically says that regimes are in serious trouble if a certain percentage of the population starts to oppose them in one way or another. So this could be, 3.5% of the population being engaged in a general in a general strike, or it could be being engaged in mass protests, or perhaps also in a rebellion. And the way that this works with mass protests is really interesting. Because of course you might ask yourself, well, how does this dictatorship become dislodged, by people just walking in the street? And the way that it functions is because once again, it forces the dictatorship into a choice between the plague and cholera, because they will tell people not to protest. And when they do protest, they can either use violence or they risk looking weak if they just let them go. But if they use violence, it can produce a backlash where you get even more people out into the streets and the situation becomes worse. And as you get more and more people in the streets, you can eventually force the regime into making a decision whether to shoot or not. But the problem is that if you give an order to shoot these unarmed protesters, you need people to actually follow that order. And at that point in past history, regimes have quite often collapsed under the weight of their own repression. Because while some soldiers might be willing to shoot at women and children, others will refuse. And at that moment, once you have given that order to shoot, but your soldiers refuse to go through with it, things become outright cataclysmic for these dictatorships. And that is how, ordinary people just marching in the streets can bring down even the most entrenched tyrants.
Well, Marcel Dursis, you have written a most thoughtful and well-researched book so relevant to our times. I want to remind our listeners again, it's How Tyrants Fall and How Nations Survive by Marcel Dursis, who has joined us today here at Reader's Corner. Marcel, thanks so much for writing the book, and thanks for being with us here at Reader's Corner.
Thank you so much.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.
What happens in Washington? The NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.